Welcome back to Following Know It on a Stormlight podcast. This week, we are on episode 224, and we are wrapping up The Sunlit Man by Brandon Sanderson. Paul and Elliot, you have read, you have found out. How does it feel, Paul?
It feels great to know everything. I'll be honest. It's really enlightening, very exciting. I will say it's a little bit bittersweet to be wrapping up this book, because we won't be doing another book wrap up for, like, I don't know, 9 months or however long it takes us to read Stormlight 5. So it'll be quite a bit until we actually wrap up another book. So very excited to do this one. Excited to talk about Sunlit Man and to go from here. Cosmere Current.
Yes, sir. Elliot, how are you?
I'm doing great. This is a fun place to be. There's a lot of knowledge that has been stuffed into my head out of these Cosmere books. It almost makes me want to immediately go back and start again and play it. It's like when you finish that video game that's really, really good, and the very first thing you want to do after beating the game is go start a new save and start from the beginning. There are not many video games that check that box for me. Reading the Cosmere checks that box for me.
The Legend of Zelda Wind Waker.
Man, you know me well.
Super Mario Galaxy for another.
There's some legendary games right there.
All right, let's roll intro, and then we're going to rate The Sunlit Man, our last book before Wind and Truth. Who wants to go first?
I think I was gonna point to Elliot. I'm happy to go first.
I'll go first.
Okay.
We have plot, characters, world building, theme, and point of view. In that order, I have rated plot a 7, characters a 9, and world building, theme, and point of view all a 10, for a total of 46 out of 50, a solid 4.5 out of 5 stars. Elliot?
I have similar-ish, 8 for plot, 8 for characters, 10 for world building. If I could do 11, I would. This is going to be my poster child for world building and the payoff it can bring. Theme 9, point of view 9, 44 out of 50, right up there with some of my highest scores ever in the Cosmere.
Wow. Those are some high scores. My score is respectable, but not as high. I had both plot and characters at a 7. I think they did well, but not this. I'm not reading this book for the plot, or for, well, we really just have a character in my mind. World building, I also had as a 10. It's fantastic. He knocks it out of the park of like the execution on world building. Theme, there's some really good moments. I gave it a 9 for theme. We talked about that a lot more in our previous episode. And point of view, a 9. I struggled to rate point of view for this book because there's only so much point of view we could get. But the point of view that we got of Sigsel and everything there was really good. Like, it was good. The interactions with him and the spread and everything were great. But for me, it felt almost kind of funny to rate point of view, I guess. It's different with these more linear books where we follow a character. But that brings my total score to a 42 out of 50.
Sounds good. Let's go through each of these and kind of pull them apart a little bit. I'm going to go in reverse order and go with point of view like you were just talking about, Paul. The way I rate point of view is A, the format of the book, and B, how do I receive information? How am I told? Are the reveals like well done? Am I interested in the info I have? Stuff like that. And I think this book does it really, really well, because these are a lot of really cool questions to be asking as a completed Cosmere reader. These are a lot of interesting questions, and I think it does it well and not getting like too lost in how many questions you could be asking. If it focuses on a couple things of Dawn Shards, future age, and I don't know, investiture and how it interacts with each other, and then kind of balances those three and moves forward with them. And so as you get to learn a little bit more through this book, I think it does a really great job.
Yeah, I think you said it. I think you said it well. You talked about the strengths of this book, and I definitely agree. I think my 9, just slightly below a 10, would be for the same reason I hit Brandon Sanderson here for most of his books, which is the tell me a little bit more about the world. That's all I want out of my point of view, is give me more descriptive writing as opposed to experiential writing. That's not his style, but I'm probably always going to give him a slight knockdown there for my own personal taste.
Paul, last week you talked about something very specific to this book, which I thought was really interesting. You highlighted the relationship between auxiliary and nomad, and how we as experienced Stormlight readers can bring something into that relationship that we know is there without having to explore it. I thought that was really cool and really well put. So going into theme here, I would have rated this a 9 had it not been for you highlighting what you just did, because there are two really, really cool things that Sanderson explores in this book, which are Stormlight adjacent. A, what happens when you live a really long time and no longer really care about your ideals? You're not running that adrenaline high of just swearing your fourth ideal. It's long in your past. What does that do to you? B, what does it do to your spread? And I think that's really, really cool to explore. So getting a full book dedicated to that concept, I think is brilliant. So which is why I gave it a 10 for theme.
That's really fair. And I'm honored to have impacted your rating, Trevor. The reasons, briefly, I want to say on point of view, I felt conflicted on, I didn't want to rate this lower than a 9, because I think it does a great job given the time it's given. But I couldn't give it a 10 in my brain, because in my brain, a 10 is the lens at which we look at the world of Stormlight, with interludes and just the vast... And it's hard for me to compare. That's why I say I struggled with this, is because it's hard to compare that to this. You know, it's apples and oranges here. But he does a great job, even though it's more linear. He does a great job of, through Sigzil's lens, showing the world, showing everything play out. With theme, there were some really great moments, and I honestly think theme was impacted because of what you were just referencing that I said previously, Trevor. We have a bit of a preconceived notion of a hero and their spren. You know, everyone kind of understands the hero and sidekick type of trope, if you will. But this is a little bit different. And the way that they are very self-sacrificial, and, you know, Sigzil becomes very attached to and caring for these people, even though they've been here for a while. And if I'm going to be selfish, you know, my selfish self, I'm like, you know, the people on this planet are not in my head compared to all the people we've seen in the Cosmere. I'm like, this is not where I want to put my stake in the ground and really lay things down. Like, you know, it was very admirable, very honorable and kind of Sigzil. So it was really good. Theme was a 9. The only reason it might not be a 10 is I feel like we don't get to a lot of that stuff until pretty far into the book, you know, kind of wrapping it up. But yeah, pretty good. And then I know we've all talked about world building, but that's knocking it out of the park.
I'll jump in and add on theme, characters, and plot. I kind of did something with my score here to address what you're talking about, Paul, which is the comparison to things like a Stormlight. I think I'm having to add in like a difficulty factor. I think Sunlit Man does everything that it's doing extremely well. Plot, awesome for what it is. Characters, awesome for what it is. But I can't give it a 10 because I need to be able to compare it to something like a Stormlight Archive, which does those things awesome and at another level, like at a whole new level of difficulty. It's like how the gymnast judges had to like rescale the scaling for Simone Biles when she came on the scene. That's what Stormlight does to the other Cosmere books. Is like, I can't tell you much about what I don't like about Sunlit Man. All I can tell you is that Stormlight does it the same and more complex, so I have to bring my score down a bit here.
Yeah. As a quick aside, I think I mentioned to Trevor a bit before this started, and I was saying, I think I need to go back and re-rate the books because I don't remember all the ratings I gave out, you know, for Way of Kings and Words of Radiance and things like that. But it's difficult because of exactly what you're saying, Elliot. I'm like, I think this book did a fantastic job with what it had. But it's not the same. The plot is not a 10 if a Stormlight plot is a 10 or a 9, you know. And I wanted to be critical of those books while we were reading them, but I don't want to give these books like a 5 or 6 for my rating, you know, because that doesn't seem fair. It's a whole thing. I'm like, I feel like I need to go back and have a more retrospective rating of the books.
I gave plot the biggest dock simply because I gave it a 7 out of 10. And the reason why is because I really enjoy how the characters interact with what's given to them. I don't really care about the plot of racing around the planet away from the Cinder King and beating him. Like, it doesn't really matter what they're doing. I'm enjoying whatever it is because of the characters and because of Brandon's writing, not because, oh, are they going to beat the Cinder King? Like, that was never a big question in my mind of, wow, this plot is really cool. Unlike what you guys are saying, Stormlight. I think the Stormlight plot is really, really cool. And there's great characters in that as well. But do I really care about the plot isolated? Not really.
I agree with you, Trevor. I think the plot was maybe my least favorite aspect of this book. Not saying it was a bad plot, but it was, I feel like this was more of a teaching book and a glimpse into the future than I'm going to write the most engaging and exciting story, right? The Cinder King wasn't, we've come from all these books where it's very cosmic in scale, very grand in scale. And it kind of felt like the Cinder King was just a little invested thug on some tiny planet. And so, you know, I was less invested in that. I will also say this, I will admit fully that the plot did not go how I expected. And I'm not saying that I graded it based off of how I thought the plot should go. But one of the things I was really hoping for, actually, ever from whenever we first started the book, we had this mention of skip capacity, knowing like this investiture level. And I was thinking back to Warbreaker and kind of the levels of heightening and the things that you kind of unlock. I was actually really hoping, this is full personal preference and speculation, I was really hoping through this book that we'd kind of slowly unlock tools. And we did a little bit where there was like connection and language and things like that. But I was actually kind of hoping for more of a progression. It kind of felt like we were always running on empty and then we got fully invested and skipped. And I was kind of really hoping for something else. Anyways, I feel like there was maybe more potential with the plot in this book. So, yeah, that's my thoughts on the whole plot aspect of this book. I do think it is a bit weaker compared to the other things, but I definitely don't think that this book was written for the plot. This was his gift to the Cosmere readers to nerd out on stuff. You know, that's what this book was.
Do we even need to talk about world building specifically at this point?
All I'll add, we tend to cross the board, right? The one thing I'll trumpet here is again, what you referenced, Trevor, to what Paul talked about an episode ago or two, there's so much about this book that is building on the world building of other books. And in such a good way, like it's taking what you've learned elsewhere and going to even the next level with it, which is just super cool. I've never read any other book ever that has done that, that has taken me along a journey that I have to follow across multiple different series, multiple different planets, worlds, completely different characters, completely different genres, and then take all that knowledge and apply it to this and allow me to really explore at another level the world building that he's working on. It's pretty incredible.
Something I will say that I think is maybe Sanderson's biggest strength, and he has plenty, is Sanderson does a really good job of capitalizing on like small specifics that he gives himself that are like really unique to where he's written to himself. Like Mistborn Era 2, for example, there's a lot of concepts in that book that are extremely specific to, okay, let's take my medieval fantasy 300 years later and then put my characters in weird situations. And I think I'm doing a poor job of explaining this here, but that's just something I've realized over the last, specifically like 2 years of this podcast, as Sanderson has gotten more current with, I'll give you another example that's a little older on the podcast. Kaladin and Dalinar, or Dalinar honorably discharging Kaladin in Rhythm of War. That there's a very specific set of circumstances that both of those characters are now reacting to, and I think Sanderson displays it extremely well. And that's really well done in this book as well. So, Auxiliary, sacrificing himself for Nomad, and moving forward, and Nomad having to move forward off Auxiliary's death, like, and the weight that that carries, I think Sanderson portrays extremely well.
Is another way to talk about that maybe the like complexity of the characters' decisions or reactions they have to make? Like those moments that you're talking about, they're so meaningful because there's so much that has built into that moment. Like you experience that moment as a reader, but if you stop and think about it, you can think through all the things the character is thinking through and going through in that moment. Like it's not just a single glimpse in time. It's built on this progression of so much that leads into a really like packed, like heavily packed, charged moment. Is that a way to say it?
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of really good payoff for the unique situations that Sanderson puts his characters in.
Yeah, I would agree.
My favorite thing about his characters while we're talking about it is especially his primary characters. He just does such a good job of fleshing out their reactions to things and how they interact with things that I feel like stories for him almost begin to write themselves. Like you can picture maybe what would happen if you put Kaladin and Rayadin and all these like different characters, Lopin or whoever. Like you could stick these characters in a room with another character, and I feel like we could kind of imagine almost what the dialogue might be like and the things that they'd say and that they'd do and how the dynamics and how they'd play off of each other. They're very dynamic, robust characters, and I really appreciate it. I will say I've been a bit pinned, rightfully so, for being a kind of secondary character hater or supporting cast. You know, they're not always my favorite, but I do want to point out in Mistborn Era 1, I think that the supporting crew and cast there have been really fantastic. This is a side note. Because the reason I'm bringing this up is because those characters have very, this might be my fault as well, because I know other characters have specific personality too, but they're given very unique personalities. If you have Breeze and Ham and some of these characters, like in these situations, they're very ridiculous and kind of out there. And so they are going to lend to very like interesting and potentially predictable or exciting moments. And I just think that's very interesting and something that Brandon does very well. So that's my tangent now on characters.
I think you're silly, Paul.
Yeah, people are probably going to be like, well, what about the secondary characters in like Tress or whoever? And I'm going to be like,
Mistborn Era 1 is where he underserves himself with the supporting cast. But that's a conversation for another day.
Wait, and who is your favorite character from that series again?
He's not in the crew.
Okay, yes, but
fired.
He's not secondary, then he's tertiary. So,
okay.
Anyways,
I liked the Sunlit Man a lot more my second time. I know that's not applicable to you two, but on my first read of Sunlit Man, here's a question for you guys. I was really overwhelmed, specifically because I didn't have anyone to talk about it with. We have the Discord discussions, but I wasn't super involved in those. So I was fairly overwhelmed with Sunlit when I first read it last year. How did you guys feel about Sunlit on your first read? Was it too much, or was it a nice rainbow road to the Cosmere's Grand Prix?
I think it was very challenging. And I will say I felt a bit overwhelmed too. I would read stuff and be like, okay, I'm just going to have to wait until we sit down and talk about it, because it was tricky. It was throwing around a lot of references and it would spell things out for you, but it'd leave a couple letters out and you still had to fill in some blanks, still had to put some pieces together. It was very dense. And so it was a bit challenging to read. I think Elliot mentioned like having to always be stopping to write notes and things while he's reading this, like more so than other books. You know, maybe he'll be noting some things down, but this is like you read a little bit and it's like, okay, we have a new term for, we have breath equivalent units, we have a Cosmere standard investiture term, we have the stuff happening on this world with the Cinder Hearts and everything going on there. We have Dawn Shards. We don't have a dragon this time. I wouldn't have been surprised if we did somehow. But we have a lot of stuff going on here with Spren off world and Hoid. It was just a lot to swallow in a shorter amount of time. And it did feel a bit overwhelming. I was thinking about it. I feel like this would be neat to reread with, you know, having some more of the information, talking about it, and then going back and reading it might actually be really nice.
I do think that it's very necessary that it's as short as it is. It's one of the shorter Sanderson works we've read that wasn't a novella. And I think it has to be, because I think Sunlit asks a lot of the reader in different ways than like a Stormlight. A Stormlight is going to be, it's a bit of an endurance battle. You've got a long way to go and you've got to muscle through. There's going to be slow chapters. There's going to be a part three of the book where you're getting long explanations and you just have to push through. This book is not that. There's no slow points. There's no like heavy analysis necessarily, but you're going to have to do a lot of mental gymnastics. You're going to have to do a lot of like thinking as you go. So for the readers that like that, for the readers that are ready for that, I think it's going to be fantastic. I do think this book is not going to be for everyone. There's going to be quite a few Cosmere readers that are definitely going to struggle with this one.
I think that's well put. Something that I'm afraid of for Wind and Truth has to do with this book. And this happened in Rhythm of War too. There's a lot of great scenes in Rhythm of War, but I feel like they get a little swamped by just the magnitude and quantity of things thrown at you in that book. And then at the end of the book, you're supposed to remember, oh yeah, Kaladin and his brother, he has mental issues there. We need to go resolve that. like that was so long ago at that point that this isn't the case for me, but I think a lot of people feel disconnected from it by the time you get there. For this book, Auxiliary at the end surrendering his life for Nomad, maybe top five Cosmere moments. I know I said that about Wayne, but this also might be up there. However, the amount of hoops you have to jump through to get there just in this short book is a lot. And then you have to remember that Auxiliary is nearly dead and now giving himself up fully. I'm just a little afraid in Wind and Truth that we're going to lose some. Like, I have no doubt that there will be incredible character moments in Wind and Truth. That's what Sanderson has been setting himself up for 15 years at this point, even longer. I'm just a little concerned that it'll be a little bit swamped out.
My biggest worry coming out of this book, and I don't want it to take away from the fact that I love this book. Hopefully my ratings portrayed that. This is fifth highest book I've rated out of the 17 or 18 books we've read. But I think maybe a detractor from this book in the context of the greater Cosmere, and we've talked a little bit about this already, if this book is going to have like a high difficulty level, like we've talked about, and there is necessary information in here, which I don't know if we even know the answer to that yet. We've read the whole book, but I can't really tell you like if there's necessary information about here. We learned about Dawn Shards a bit. We've learned about some other things, like we got introduced to the Night Brigade, I guess, maybe some other kind of bits and pieces. I hope what we learned here is not necessary going forward. I hope that if Dawn Shards are relevant later, we're going to get all the information we need elsewhere. Otherwise, there's going to be some nuggets of information locked behind a high difficulty, and that's going to, I think, maybe hurt some people's Cosmere experiences because of that. So hopefully it becomes like the Easter egg book. If you want to go hunting for Easter eggs, have at it, but you don't have to.
I think that's well put. I agree with you completely on Wind and Truth. The less it's required for Wind and Truth, and like you said, I don't think we know the answer to that right now. The less it's required for Wind and Truth, the better. However, I'm fine with it being the bottleneck to the second great chapter of Brandon Sanderson books, where we're moving into Mistborn Era 3, moving into Stormlight Era 2, you know, moving into the late 2020s, late or early 2030s of Brandon Sanderson books. I'm fine with this being required for that. I just don't want it to be required for Wind and Truth. Kind of in that similar vein. For you guys personally, moving forward, does our big plot points and settings that Brandon Sanderson seems to be setting up interest you guys? Namely, the Night Brigade introduced in this book, the Cosmere arms race set up in this book, kind of Scadrial versus Roshar, or, you know, the big players in the Cosmere, and then like the modern age Ghost Bloods and whatever they're up to from the Lost Metal. Do each of those arcs interest you moving forward or not? I'm kind of lukewarm on them. The more I read on them, the more they do interest me. But if you were to ask me, am I more interested in reading another Way of Kings versus moving forwards with modern age Ghostbloods, I'd want to read, you know, something standalone again, I think. But what do you guys think?
So I'm going to pick apart your question a little bit, Trevor, because there's some things I do think are neat, like the Night Brigade. I think that was pretty neat, and I'd be curious to know more, because I want to know why Sigzil was being chased. You know, We know we had a Dawn Shard and it's like related to that, but there's a lot of missing pieces between the Sigil we knew and here. And that's what I'm actually more interested in that than maybe what is allegedly coming after this. You know, the arms race and kind of the modern age ghost blood stuff. I'm not that invested in. However, you know, at the end of the Lost Metal, I was very curious, and a lot of that kind of raised the standard for me with that, with the Ghostbloods. So I'm not saying that I will never be interested in that, but right now I feel like some of this other information that we already have and the Night Brigade are more what I'm curious about. This other stuff, I'm like, that's a future, that's a Mistborn 3 problem. I will visit that at that time. Right now, I really don't have any specific interest in it. And I mean, I'm ready to be proved wrong again. I was nervous going into Mistborn Era 2 with the increase of technology. I'm nervous again going further with technology. But Sanderson has proved each time with each book that we've read that he does a really good job with it. He did a great job with technology in Yumi and in Mistborn Era 2, and in this book, just kind of all over. He's done a great job. So I'm just ready to be proved wrong even more.
Just real quick, I'll jump in there. I am also looking forward to being proven wrong again, because I'm hesitant moving forward, but Mistborn Era 2 specifically, some of my favorite Cosby books written, and moving into them, I was really not excited about them, but they really impressed me.
I agree with a lot of what you guys are saying, so I'm not going to say it again. I'll add one additional fear that I have, or maybe a trap that I'm hoping Brandon sees and is not going to fall into it. And that trap that I can see potentially lying in wait is the, I'll call it the escalation paradox. The problem where I hope Brandon doesn't feel like he has to continue to one-up himself as he goes. And specifically, I mean with like the scale of events. We've talked before about how as we go through the Cosmere, it feels like we're kind of zooming out and zooming out and zooming out. I really hope that does not continue, actually. Because if we keep going further and further out, if we keep escalating events, if each series has to bring a bigger, more calamitous, more jaw-dropping moment, that's cool in a sense that we're getting to explore new and new things. We bring in technology into this Cosmere arms race. That kind of sounds epic and dramatic. But at the same time, I think what will start to happen is it's going to start to cheapen the previous events. It's going to start to make the events of previous books feel less weighty, less valuable. And so while it might be tempting for him to keep ratcheting up the scale more and more and more, I think it will actually hurt the Cosmere in the long run if he does that. And so I'm hoping that as he moves into the future eras, as he goes here, as we get more technology, maybe more like space opera style of where we're going for, I hope he doesn't get sucked into an escalation paradox.
I felt the same until these secret projects came out, because I think all three of them actually run it really well of keeping the stakes low and engaging. Where Tress and Yumi specifically, like, you know, Sunlit turns it up a little bit, and you need to be aware of other stuff going on in the Cosmere to get the full punch of Sunlit. But I think Tress and Yumi specifically are really, really nice stories dialed down, like you're saying, and not ramped up.
The trick is going to be, how do you, like in a Stormlight Era 2 or a Cosmere Era, or not a Mistborn Era 4, you know, those kinds of things. How do you give it the complexity that we've seen in like a Stormlight Era 1 without necessarily cheapening your previous series? I think that's going to be challenging, because these stories, I completely agree with you, did a very good job. But they also, like we just talked about in our ratings, aren't quite at the complexity level of those. So I still want to see more of that, but I don't want him to one up his other series.
How do you guys feel about the different tone of Sunlit versus pretty much anything else that he's made. But set aside Mistborn Era 2 for a second, because I think that's a little bit odd. Brandon Sanderson is pretty well established as a fantasy writer. I don't know if this is a fantasy book. Do you guys have strong feelings on the different tone of Sunlit?
I don't know that it felt to me that far off. I mean, it is more sci-fi, perhaps, than fantasy here. But it's still pretty fantastical with a lot of the stuff. But it is, it's a bit different. I'm struggling to put my finger on it exactly. But it is, I guess it didn't feel all that different to me. I mean, definitely tone and like setting, like this is a different world, but it's not the darkest world we've seen, I would argue. And it may be the most dangerous, maybe the place I'd want to be the least.
Would you say it's the brightest world we've ever seen?
maybe so. It might be that. It's very perilous. And to me, it felt like we had a large problem, as in Sigzil being here and what he's going through. It felt like we had a large problem on a small, in a little pond, you know? And I think that's what was different to me. I wasn't thinking about like the sprawling like cityscapes and all the like inventiveness of the world and like Yumi and Tress respectively. But we were like learning a lot about technology and the Ghostbloods and investiture and things like that. Yeah, I don't know if I have much more to add, Trevor. I feel like it didn't feel as different to me. It felt different in what I needed to know and how it was read, but not necessarily different in like a fantasy sense to me.
I'm not super well read outside of fantasy, and even within fantasy, I don't know that I'm super broadly read, but I don't quite know what to call this book for sure. Sci-fi, yeah, probably, but not like any other sci-fi book I've read. It definitely still stays in a bit of the fantasy realm. Honestly, the best comparison I can make is to, I brought this up before, books like The Martian by Andy Weir, which are very like almost first person in the head of one character trying to solve problems with that character as they're doing it, not really going into a broad perspective, staying very kind of narrow focused. I don't quite know how to describe that as a style or as a genre, but Sunlit Man is that, whatever it is.
Yeah. I definitely feel a weight of difference between Sunlit and pretty much anything else that Brandon has made. And I think that's a good thing, simply because if no other reason, because it makes, I think these secret projects have clearly made Brandon a better writer and a more confident writing exercise as like this 2-year stint that he had. So all three of these secret projects are very different from anything he'd previously done. And even Sunlit is different than the other two. So I think that diversity is a great strength.
Real quick on that, I think that's actually huge. How often does an author get to do this, get to kind of write for fun and then publish it however they want, to have full control over it, to go crazy with art and fancy book design? And you know, who else gets to do that? You hear about authors doing, you know, for fun projects all the time, but do they like actually get to publish them? Rarely, or if they do, it's in like a super cheap volume or included in a, you know, anthology with other works kind of buried in the back and hardly anybody reads it. The fact that Brandon just got to have some fun with it and then be so incredibly successful with distributing it and publishing it and getting people reading it and talking about it, that could be incredibly freeing and developing for him as an author to have to been able to go through that process that probably very few other authors ever get to do.
I don't know if you guys were super well tuned in last year to the whole Dragonsteel versus Tor publisher like back and forth that they had, but Brandon Sanderson made it clear that he wasn't declaring war on his publisher, but that he was exploring other alternatives in case, you know, Amazon and Tor and all the established publishers, you know, didn't listen to him. He's like, I don't, he's displaying that he doesn't necessarily need them. So that there was that as well. Anything else on general thoughts before we move into characters or favorite characters?
Now we hit all my points.
Okay. Favorite characters for Sunlit. I have Zellion. And I first wrote Auxiliary. However, Auxiliary is too annoying for too much of the book to be my favorite. And sure, he shines brighter than most Cosmere characters at the end of this book, but it's the Wayne effect. He doesn't quite... He's too annoying. So Zellion.
Well, I also had Zellion as well.
And I'm going to take us on a clean sweep. We've got a unanimous answer here, and that Zellion is, I think, also my favorite character. I do got to sneak in an honorable mention of Elegy.
Who?
Just to make you guys groan at me. Yeah, whatever.
Thank you, Trevor.
You're welcome.
Ox holds a special place in this story for sure, but I think Elegy is the dark horse in this book. She had a criminally underrated plot line by my co-hosts on this podcast.
I do want to say this book, more than any other novel that we've read, you're really left with the one protagonist, you know, like there are others that you can be happy for and root for here, but we are just seeing through one lens, and it's somebody that we know as a Cosmere reader. I think if he took even if you took that away, if this is just Nomad, someone who we did not know, totally new person, totally random person in the Cosmere, even still, like you are, this book is geared to be his perspective and his story, and that's what you have. So it's kind of hard to have a favorite character that's not Zellion in this.
Is this our first unanimous vote?
It definitely is.
I think it must be.
For a favorite character, it's definitely our first unanimous vote.
Yeah, I agree with you, Paul. If you don't like Zellion, you're probably not going to like this book. Because I agree. Sure. This book is... it's a character study of him. It's the whole book is him.
Well, I think that is neat. I think that detracts a little bit for me, because if I'm, you know, other books that we're reading, I feel like I get to, you know, if I do reread this, as a side note, I will try to pay more attention to Elegy, for the record. But with our other books, I feel like you get a lot more dynamics with a lot of other characters. I mean, like, part of the book is he can't even understand what these people are saying. Like, you know, he can't speak the language and things like that. You're just not really given time or opportunity to get to know people. And even still, it's very different from the others. Even ones that I've probably wrongfully misjudged or not appreciated the supporting cast of characters, they are seemingly a lot more present and involved, maybe, or not really present or involved, but given more time to shine and more space to shine in any of our other secret projects, for example, in Yumi and in Tress. And of course, in our main novels, they're obviously given a lot more time to show up. So yeah, I feel like it's a bit different, because you don't get as much of a cast. You get a protagonist, you know? How do y'all feel about that? Are you like, yeah, I'm happy reading a book that we're just following a character. You know, like what, for example, Stormlight, right? Book one is Kaladin's book, right? We get his backstory, but obviously you get so much other perspective. Would you still like love and enjoy? Obviously you would still love and enjoy it, but would it, what would you prefer of like, if it was really Kaladin's book, like just Kaladin's perspective, essentially, versus like kind of a larger approach, you know? Did y'all like having the zoomed in approach to Zellion here, or do you prefer kind of the other books?
So with the Way of Kings specifically, I think as a first-time reader, especially a first-time Cosmere reader, if the Way of Kings is the first thing I'm picking up, which it was, I think the plot would be served by extracting Shallan out of the book and having a Shallan novella between the Way of Kings and Words of Radiance. However, I think the world building is underserved by doing that. The reveal at the end of the book of the Voidbringers are the Parshendi. Like, whoa, that's like a big deal for our other storyline over here of the Shattered Plains. We've been fighting Voidbringers this whole time. That's crazy. And you don't get that without Shallan. So would I personally like Shallan cut out of the Way of Kings? No. But I think there are plenty of people who would tell you yes. Just give me Kaladin and a little bit of Dalinar so I understand who this is as he's surrendering the sword. There are plenty of people, early publishers included, early editors included, who would tell Brandon, you need to cut this out and give the plot and only the plot. So for me, no.
I like Sunlit Man exactly how it is, as the cream of the crop side quest. It's a side journey. It's a subplot in the greater story. Do I enjoy drilling down on one character only? Definitely yes. I still am going to prefer in the larger picture, the main quest, if you will, the multi-perspective, the interwoven complex analysis that is the epic fantasy. And that's just what I like better. I think you can do so much more with that. You can do things like adjust your pacing. This book doesn't really move the needle much on pacing. It's kind of one pace the whole way. Bit of a Sanderlanch towards the end. And that's fine for exactly what it is. But I think there's other things you can do with A Way of Kings to be in the midst of action and then force your reader to slow down with a boring Shallan chapter. And as annoying as that might be to some, I think it actually adds an incredible value to the overall experience, even if people are going to take it a little bit begrudgingly. And so my answer is, along with Trevor, journey before destination, it's, you're supposed to work for it.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I definitely like what you said, Elliot, about it being like almost a side quest. Like, you know, we have our novellas who give, you know, a little more insight into a specific character. This is just more of the extreme version, in my opinion, of just one character. Not even a character and a couple others, but just like a character mostly. And so I feel like that was almost a bit discombobulating, but it is really good for what it is. Like, it, you know, obviously very good. And I agree. I don't know that it's probably unfair for me to ask. I don't think it's comparable because, of course, we like the dynamics of a rich story with a lot of characters. But yeah, that's really something I'm just realizing is how singular it is driven by one character.
All right. Normally we would move into favorite quotes, but this time we only have one. I read mine last week, so you can go replay that if you'd like at this segment. But Elliot had one more that he would like to throw in before we close this book. So what do you have, Elliot?
Yeah, I do have a good one that I don't think I got to read in our previous episodes. And it actually sums up the book fairly well. And actually, knowing the end of this book completely changes the context of what I'm about to read. So think about this in context and kind of in the moment as well. This is the moment where Nomad is flying the ship over the mountain. And he's fixed the problems with the ship. So we've made it at this point. He's like coasting up over the mountain, but they've left the atmosphere. So there's no air, so he can't talk. Auxiliary is like monologuing at him this whole time. And all that Nomad can do is like send emotions back. And this is one of the things they talk about. This is Auxiliary speaking pretty much the whole time. What is life about if not growth? I don't like the person I was back on Roshar either, before we knew each other. I like change, Nomad. My kind were too static for too long, particularly we Heisbren. And sometimes the way you talk makes me think you believe, or can pretend, that you are an entirely different person now. But you aren't. You're still that man. The capacity for what you've become was always there. I guess that sounds depressing or negative, but I don't mean it so. If we pretend that we're a different person each day, then what good does it do? It implies we can't truly change, that we don't learn. We just turn into another being. Does that make sense? Barely. I just want to say, I'm glad to be here. Seeing this all with you, even with the cost, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, that's really good. Because at the end of the book, he reminds Zelian of that again, that he really can change and isn't as bad as he gives himself credit for.
Well, and Auxiliary doubles down on it too. He talks there about the cost. He's referring to like the damage that's been done to him by the Dawn Shard. He's like, I don't mind that I've been reduced to almost nothing because I've gotten to experience this all with you and see this change. At the end, he accepts death. He sacrifices himself. He pays the ultimate cost to see Nomad become a better man. Comes full picture.
If he just wasn't so annoying, he'd be my favorite.
Wow. Brutal.
I bet. Did you audiobook this time, Trevor?
Yes.
I wonder if that's a little bit heightened in the audiobook, if the reader is truly reading him in the like monotone that he's supposed to be. Like, I probably did not read that accurately, did I? Because in reality, Auxiliary is supposed to be like this monotone, has lost all voice inflection kind of thing. I can see that being annoying, whereas my headcanon voice is far less so.
That's a good point. But I really appreciate Auxiliary in this book because he adds so much of the valuable theme that does get to shine in this book of what you read there. And especially knowing that he kind of gives himself up is really impactful and really good. So,
all right. Setting Sunlit down and looking back at 2023 as a whole, do a little bit of comparison between the secret projects before we end this episode. Which one was your favorite secret project? And which one was the best written? Because I have a different answer for both. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. My favorite and what I think is the most well written is Secret Project 2, The Frugal Wizard's Guide.
Have you even read that?
No, I have not. I'm sorry. I just had
to get off joke. This podcast.
I have not read it. Whether or not you're a fan of it, I just wanted to make the joke because it's the one that we have not read. So I'm sorry.
But I haven't read it either.
Wow. I thought you had read it. Anyways, in all seriousness, I do actually have the same answer for both of these questions. And my answer is Yumi. I do think Yumi is the best. And it was my personal favorite. I think the dynamic, the kind of yin and yang dynamic was really beautifully written. And there were some very sweet moments. And it had yeah, I feel like it was very dynamic and good. Yeah, I'll leave it at that.
I will say that I think the best written is Tress and not Yumi. I think Yumi fumbles the ball a little bit at the end. I think 80% of that book is great, and then the ending kind of gets a little lost in the weeds. I think the best written is Tress, and my favorite is Sunlit. And my favorite is Sunlit simply because of I'm a sucker for great Cosmere character moments, and Auxiliaries blows them all away. So, you know, Sunlit's my favorite for that reason. But I think as a whole package, Tress is the best.
This is fascinating because I'm gonna round out the triad here and say that I think Sunlit Man is the best written. I think the other two suffer is the wrong word. It makes it sound more negative than I intend. But I think the other two suffer a little bit from the Hoid perspective. The Hoid narrator takes it into
that's a brilliant.
Well, it is. It actually is. It's incredibly creative. It's a ton of fun, but it's not the best writing. I think it takes it into a bit of a silly category, which I enjoy 100%. I think they're great. I think he was being incredibly creative, flexing new muscles, doing it incredibly well. They're great books. But I think Sunlit Man, where he steps it back into a little bit more serious of a space, he really can show what he can do with one single character like we've been talking about. And I think he does that incredibly well. I think the level of polish that is on Sunlit Man is higher than Yumi and Tress. And so I think for that, it's the best written and my favorite, just because of the themes and the journey that we go on, the epic scenes were the highest in my estimation. I do want to shout out though to Yumi. I think Yumi is a close second for a couple of different reasons, and definitely would take like the most creative and the most fun award of the three. He definitely went in a direction I was not expecting to go, and I really enjoyed Yumi. It was quite fun to read, but I think Sunlit is still the best.
I think Yumi might be high on my reread list once Wind and Truth is done. I don't remember as much about that book as I wish I had, so maybe I'll go reread that soonish, you know, year and a half or whatever. Anything else before we close Sunlit Man?
I don't think so. I mean, only thing else I can think of is just to maybe shout out the design of the books yet again. I still blows me away the quality behind these books and just the amount of thought that went into the art and the page design and the black coloring on the edges and how that just makes you feel appreciated as a reader. Like these books were created to spoil the reader, and they do it well.
I think you make a great point, Elliot. The three secret projects that we've read are, y'all don't see my actual bookshelves here. They're in our living room, but the three secret project books that we have are some of the like centerpieces, if you will, that we have. You know, they're some of the most beautiful books that Alex and I have in our, you know, kind of shelf collection. And so absolutely fantastic. My joking side note is also that there are some of the biggest disparity between versions with the nice. If you have the nice version of Yumi versus the like mass market version of Yumi, it's literally night and day difference. And I think maybe some of the same with some of the others. That it's really just because these books, I don't know what to call it. I don't know if it's a leather bound special edition, whatever. They're so well done, so much attention to detail, and just so beautiful that it knocks so much out of the water.
Sounds good. Paul and Elliot, the next book we will be reading on this podcast is Wind and Truth by Brandon Sanderson. Starting the first week of December, we will have some Wind and Truth content as the book is released that Friday. Between now and then, which I think is about 2 to 3 weeks or so, we will have some different content on the podcast feed in preparation for Wind and Truth. So until December, not a standard reading schedule, but certainly content to look forward to. Thank you for joining me, Paul and Ilya.
I could not be more excited. Sunlit Man was the perfect appetizer. Now bring on the main course. Let's go.
Absolutely. After many, years at this point, we're revisiting the Stormlight Archive. Until we meet again.
On we go.